Hello and welcome to The Convex Conversation with me, journalist Helen Fosbero. Today's guest shares a big passion of mine, saving Britain's pubs. And during lockdown, Chef Tom Kerridge has been putting his expertise in that field to good use for a compelling BBC Two series. Tom runs the Hand and Flowers in the beautiful Georgian town of Marlow in Buckinghamshire, the first pub in the world to be awarded 2 Michelin stars. He owns other fine establishments, has written a selection of cookery books, has been on countless TV programmes, and lives with his wife Beth, who's a sculptor, and their young son. Tom, thanks so much for joining me today. I know you're probably really, really hectic, so I appreciate you finding the time. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks, mate. Like I say, yeah, a little bit busy, running around, doing lots. You know, we're trying to organise different businesses up and down the country and trying to work out what on earth is going on. But yeah, no, it's an absolute pleasure.
And I've got my brother to thank for this. He saw you talking about your BBC Two series, Saving Britain's Pubs, and knew that we'd get on, as I've been campaigning to save Britain's pubs with actor Neil Stuke for the last few years. So let's talk pubs first. I mean, they've been closing at an alarming rate for years, way before the pandemic, haven't they?
They have, yeah. Pubs are under a huge amount of pressure. I mean, we hear about it all the time. So many pubs are closing. It's around about 3 a week are shutting, and that's pre-pandemic. The numbers moving forward from there are going to be a lot more. We hear all the time of why it's happening. And it was the point of doing the TV show and looking into it a little bit more is to kind of show to the general public, you know, the sort of pressures that pubs are under. And each individual one has its own individual set of challenges. There's not a blanket reason why pubs are closing, but there are so many different points and different pressures that are put on the pub business from all over. I suppose the reaction that we had from it, from general public, and the understanding is that one is a huge amount of compassion for the landlords that are in it. And the amount of work that it takes to run a pub, you know, it may be under the illusion that you kind of open the door, turn the fruit machines on, and there you go, the pub's packed. And it's just not like that. The reality of it is it's almost a 24-hour day job. So I think showing everybody the realities of what it's like to run a pub with those different pressures that put the pub under attack, it seems to have gone down very well as a programme and as a show, but it just highlights all the different issues that pubs face.
You met some amazing characters, as pub landlords usually are, some though with heartbreaking stories. Did some of them get to you a bit, Tom?
Well, they all do. I mean, I'm quite lucky. I quite like meeting people. I'm a people person. I quite enjoy the company of people, which is what amazing pubs are. They're about that social interaction and engagement. And the one thing that I wanted to bring to the show was, I suppose, just a little bit of my experience of running pubs over the last 15 years and being able to just question what these guys were doing. Not necessarily, they weren't necessarily doing anything wrong, any of them, but it was just a case of going, perhaps you should be doing, or what about doing this, or have you thought about doing that, or, you know, just trying to give them a little nudge in a direction that may suit their business a little better. You know, although, you know, my background is being a chef, the understanding of making businesses work, we're pretty multifaceted. You know, we've got pubs and butchers and festival businesses and events companies. I've been in hospitality for over nearly 30 years. I was going to say, I was putting years on me then, almost 30
Don't
years.
Don't do that.
But it, no.
Just say more, I always say more than 25 when yeah. I talk about my journalism.
So it was just trying to use that little bit of experience to help these guys just have a reassess and relook at their business and about what they could do to be proactive about attacking that market space. And, you know, there's so many different aspects that affect pubs and pub life. You know, it could be the community that they're in. So Lana, whose pub, The Golden Anchor, was down in Nunhead near Peckham. And that area, that community had grown and developed over the 20 years that she'd had it. She just hadn't moved with the community, the way it became now much more culturally rich and diverse. I mean, she hadn't kind of moved with the time. So she had a lot of catching up to do, which, you know, puts you straight away on the back foot. And then there was a music pub up in Stroud that faces the challenge that you hear about a lot of the time, is the big pub companies that own the pub. So how does the pub landlord then kind of fight his way to a fair deal that feels not too heavily weighted to the pub company. Then there's people whose lives they'd sold a house and bought a pub freehold, and it was just trying to, how do we make this work? You know, that's quite difficult. And then it was a community-owned pub in Scotland, so everybody owned it. So there were 250 owners, which proves a little, you know, there's a lot of opinions there. And it was all being run by volunteers, so volunteer fatigue. But all of these issues pubs face, so many different reasons. But I think, you know, probably the biggest one, you know, you get cheaper alcohol in supermarkets, and you get people's drinking habits have changed, and, you know, higher rates of tax, staff are more expensive, you know, in terms of minimum wage, and all of these pressures are put on the pub that people don't understand. That's why your pint costs in many cases over £5, you know, trying to get your head around it.
Good God.
Yeah.
I'm glad I don't drink pints. I mean, you must have been a breath of fresh air, Tom, going in with all your ideas. I did an hour special for The One Show featuring communities up and down the country who were trying to save their locals, often from developers turning them into flats, which is another thing that puts pubs under pressure. And also we were highlighting the plight of tenants going under because of the beer tie, where, as you mentioned, they're forced to buy alcohol at inflated prices from some of the big pub companies. But what drove me when I was working on this, and we did save a few pubs, which was great, was their role in community and the loss once they're gone. So we saved the Checker Inn in Ash, which was 15th century and the last pub in the village, and it's now owned by the villagers. They're so important, aren't they? It's not just a place to eat and drink. It's a community hub.
Yeah, it's huge. And I think that's the biggest thing that we've probably recognised throughout 2020 is not the product that they sell. It's not beer and wine or food, you know, because you can buy that anyway. You can buy that from the supermarket. You know, that is essentially the product that pubs sell. And this is where I think so much of the government messaging or the understanding of the industry itself, it has been wrong. It's just been thought about what it sells rather than about what it delivers, what it gives you, the experiences, the connection, the communication, the relief of mental stress, the relief of loneliness, the social interaction. You know, it could still be physically distant, that could still be COVID safe. But what it creates, you know, when you go into a pub or a restaurant or anywhere in hospitality, you know, when you go with your friends or your family, you're not the only person there. You're not the only people there. The place is busy and it's full, and everybody signs this unwritten contract of going, we're all there to create energy and atmosphere. That's what creates a great space, a buzz, a noise of people having fun and a lovely time. And that's what we all miss. And that's what we miss usually in 2020, is that social connection. And moving forward, that's where we need to be getting back. And that's where pubs offer so much more. They're interwoven into the fabric of society. And it's the lack of understanding that I think has come from government and the powers and the scientists within Sage and the world. You know, they're not necessarily pub-going people. They might be quite lucky that they've got quite a nice big house with a garden, and they can order themselves an expensive bottle of red wine and enjoy that just sitting at home watching the television. You know, there's many people who live in shared accommodation in high-rise flats in very, very small townhouses with no form of escape. And pubs, they became living rooms of communities, and that's where they're so, so important. And that's why they're desperate. We must save them, because the people that kind of make the decisions don't necessarily live the life or have the understanding of what wet-led community or even estate-led pubs give. What their purpose is much more than just selling booze.
Certainly right. I love it when you find a pub that's also taken over the post office and you can buy fresh bread and all that kind of thing and really serves the community. But, you know, now we're in 2021 and we're all trying to put 2020 behind us. What are your hopes for the future of pubs now, given how dreadful and devastating 2020 was for so many people?
Well, it's, you know, the hardship is still going to be coming. You know, we've kind of bumbled through to the end of the year, and, you know, now looking forward into 2021, we're in a very difficult position in terms of being able to rejuvenate and rebuild. The furlough scheme runs through till March at this point, and the job losses start falling away. This is when it starts happening. When that support system, that network, that kind of like scaffolding that's built around trying to hold everything up right now, the moment we start removing that, that's when pubs start collapsing and failing without business support, without ongoing VAT relief, without ongoing, you know, that's another thing that's been a problem for pubs, is wet-led pubs haven't had that reduction in VAT on alcohol. It really does make a massive difference to pubs being able to operate. Still, you know, a reduction in VAT of 15%, I mean, if you haven't got any turnover there, 15% of nothing is still nothing. It doesn't matter. So it's encouraging the pubs to exist, people to get back into them and move forward. And I think the one thing as an industry that we've been massively exposed, and I think, and I hope that the government recognised that over the last year as an industry, without us having a minister for hospitality, a ministry for hospitality, this is an industry that employs directly 3.2 million people. And then indirectly on top of that, another 2 million people through supply chain. It's the third largest industry. It employs 10% of the UK workforce. It is huge. It is a massive industry that provides so much in the terms of GDP and tax and everything for the government. And the problem we got is that pubs and restaurants sit in one ministerial office and tourism, travel and hotels sit in another. So all that mixed messaging that we had in 2020 is because there's two ministerial offices and a SAGE advisory board all talking to each other, but nobody, there's no one in the middle. There is no one in charge, no one in control. There's three different areas that are coming in, and it felt, and we could see now in retrospect why it felt so mixed messaging, why we're doing some, there's tier systems and there's some rules for this and you can't do this, but you can do that and you can't, you know, all of it felt so contradictory. And this is where I think moving forward, the positivity from it is that we do need to create that minister and ministry of hospitality, because it's so important for the rest of the country to be moving forward. It is integral to many other businesses. And I don't just mean in a supply chain. I mean in any business, in terms of trade, in terms of conversations. It's the engine room of everything that we do within this country. Business meetings happen in hotels or function rooms or meeting spaces where sandwiches and coffee are served. Who's doing that? That's hospitality. People go out for dinner after securing deals or making things move forward or taking people out for business or working lunches. People go for drinks to celebrate. People do, you know, coffee shops. You know, everything about hospitality is that engine room, that driving force of every other business. It is part of our social infrastructure that the businesses, no matter what it's in, whether you're in manufacturing, whether you're in, I don't know, medicine or science or pharmaceuticals, whether you're in hospitals, there are always those points where you need hospitality that has been taken for granted. So moving forward, we need the recognition that hospitality should be there for the creativity of every other business to be able to self-generate and move forward, making 2021 a much better year. And, you know, I still don't think we're going to be back on our feet for another 2 or 3 years, to be honest.
I think you're right. I mean, you explained that really well. And of course, something I feel really strongly about is supporting all the farmers, and they're part of all of that too, in a different department, the Department of Agriculture. But of course, this has had a massive knock on, hasn't it, with all the pubs and restaurants being closed for our British farmers who work so hard to deliver amazing food. But it also really annoyed me to hear people in the industry described as low skilled. My Uncle Jack and Auntie Dolly ran the King's Head in Lincolnshire many, many moons ago in the 70s. And they were incredible at what they did. Did that get you a bit annoyed as well when you kept hearing that?
More than annoyed. It's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, those words coming from senior ministerial offices. Again, people in senior positions, that shows a complete lack of understanding of what this industry brings. You know, there is a difference between low skilled and lower paid. Okay. So yes, it is an industry that operates. Many people are on minimum wage. And that it's because there is no serious value and so serious huge money in it. It is an industry run on passion and love, and for the people that run hospitality, they love being around people and providing for guests that come through the door. That's amazing. But also the people that brew beer, make cheese, distill spirits, make wine, farming, look after cattle, grow carrots, whatever. You know, these are all jobs that are passion led. They're not there for commercial gain. Yes, they have to kind of make money, because otherwise, you know, you don't pay anything. But people don't choose these jobs because they want to earn cash. They choose these jobs because they love them. They're not jobs, they're ways of life. And that's the wonderful thing about food. So when you hear ministers talk about it as low skilled, my first reaction to that is, well, I would very much like to see Priti Patel cooking 80 main courses in a 2-Michelin-star restaurant on a Saturday night, each single one perfectly, and telling me that that is low skilled. It was the most absurd and actually quite upsetting and quite derogatory, and showed complete lack of understanding of our industry.
Absolutely. What really made my heart sing was when I realised that, you know, we'll talk about the Hand and Flowers and your 2 Michelin stars and all the amazing food you cook, but I loved the fact that you cooked for the NHS workers, didn't you, during lockdown, which I think is amazing. That must have been great fun. very satisfying, and I'm sure it was much appreciated, was it, Tom?
Yeah, well, during that period, that lockdown one, we had all the staff on furlough. We have a huge event company in terms of, like, it's got a great big commercial kitchen that's in a warehouse. We have this massive operational space that obviously we're doing nothing. That event company worked in Premier League football, Formula One, and working with an airline. So obviously, first lockdown, there was no one at Formula One, there was no football matches, and no planes were flying. So as a company, it was sat there doing very, very little. We set up a charity called Meals from Marlow. We were kind of answering a call from one of the hospitals nearby in Slough, who said that their staff were, you know, this is when everyone was stockpiling loo roll and pasta. So they weren't being able to, they were eating out of vending machines, and there was nothing in the supermarkets when they could get out. So we were like, well, okay, well, maybe we should do a few meals. We got plenty of time and staff to be able to do this. So I rang around every supplier, got as much free stuff as possible. Everyone was so supportive. It was huge. And then all the staff volunteered, and we did a GoFundMe page. It raised over £180,000. And by the end of Christmas, we fed 100,000 people. So it was great. And that went into frontline NHS workers and the vulnerable and the needy within Marlow, Maidenhead, High Wycombe, Slough areas. We've set it up as a registered charity now. So it's still there to provide us as that, I suppose, that platform and a vehicle to do things for good moving forward with food when people need it.
That's awesome. Well done for that. I've read in interviews where you've said that your job as a chef and what you do defines you. But before we sort of really talk about that, will you take us back, Tom, to the sort of mid-70s and 80s? I think you were brought up with your brother largely by your mum, weren't you, as a single parent through much of your childhood. I just wondered, what was growing up like, and where did that passion for food come from?
Passion for food didn't really happen until I went into a kitchen. And it was, I grew up as a single parent family. You know, my mum had two jobs. I would cook tea for my brother. It was just like, you know, but that was things like fish finger sandwiches. And
birds, you weren't doing Michelin starred food at that stage for your brother.
Bird's eye potato waffles, Findus crispy pancakes, those sort of things, you know, children of the 80s.
Oh, you take me back.
But I went into the kitchen when I was 18 years old, and because I needed a job. And all of a sudden I fell in love with, it's not food. Being a chef is, so many people kind of confuse being a chef as people who, it's all about food. The food is the thing that we do. It is the product, and it is the thing that we create and we make. But it's much more than that. Being a chef is a way of life. The stoves, the heat, the adrenaline, the excitement, it's very, very different to cooking in a domestic kitchen. You know, you're still doing the same sort of product. Being a chef, there's so much more focus about the vocation of what the job actually is. And that's what drew me to the industry, the excitement, the energy levels, and the late nights and the early mornings and the left field way of life. It's kind of like a secret club. Unless you really work in the hospitality industry, you don't get it. If your job is a 9-to-5, Monday to Friday job, you know, you see the hospitality industry as, my God, that's unsociable. I wouldn't want to do that. It's the most sociable. It's the best. You know, it's just different. You know, it's just different, but it is the most incredible kind of like slightly chaotic left field way of life. And it's amazing. And that's the other thing, that where the hospitality industry is so important, because it is one of the major employers of young people, you know, under 25s, people that leave college and university, or people have a job during college or university. You know, many people who leave school and it is their first kind of working positions in the real world, you know, where they're given opportunities before they go on to do something else. You know, it's such a wonderful transient industry, and then it's full of energetic and young people. And that's why it's so important to keep going.
Tom, I'm certainly not 9-to-5 in my job. I suppose live telly's been my thing, and a lot of people can't imagine doing live television. But I honestly can't imagine the stress and pressure of working in a kitchen. I mean, it seems like you really thrive in that environment. And is that part of what you really fell in love with in those early days when you were chefing?
Yeah, it's that adrenaline that you get. And that's what chefs love, that excitement, that fear of failure. You've got two deadlines every day. You know, you've got lunch and dinner, and then you might have a function on top of that. There's always something that you're under pressure. People who do well in this industry are people that enjoy being under pressure. They thrive on having to get things done. You can't work to anybody else's agenda. You have to work to the structures that are in place. And this is the timing scales. And this is where it's got to be. And it has to be ready by then. And there is no question about it. You can't just float about in your own little world. It has to be driven. And that's why it's so important.
Give us a sense of what you're like in the kitchen when the heat's on and the pressure's on.
I get very wound up quite quickly about stupid little things, things that people have repeatedly got wrong or things that just aren't right. It's just tiny, daft little things. They're the things that you find more frustrated. When things go horribly wrong, that's when the kitchen should be incredibly calm. That's where it's structured. That's where those points are. The reality is making the guest happy. And that's what we do. You know, the aim is to make the guest happy.
And do sometimes things go horribly wrong?
All the time. Things go wrong.
Do they?
Not horribly wrong, but there's, you know,
they'd go wrong if I was in your kitchen, that's for sure.
food goes to the wrong table, or something's overcooked, or something's undercooked, or somebody doesn't like it. There's a mousse hasn't set, or a thing. All of those sort of things, they happen, and they happen all the time. The key to being good restaurateurs or publicans is understanding how to deal with it, making sure that the guest is happy. There are human beings, and when there's lots of human beings around, errors happen. You know, people aren't perfect. We're not robots. That's why every day is different. It's very fluid. I come into work every day and, you know, you read the service reports at the end of the night and trying to work out what's gone wrong, what's broken. How do we need to sugarcoat or repair things the next morning? How do we make it right? So every single day, those are the things that you're always looking at, trying to problem solving, sometimes small scale, sometimes much bigger.
We saw you on BBC Two trying to help publicans and landlords, you know, turn their establishments around. And you are hugely successful in what you do. Where does that business acumen come from, do you think? Or has it been a learning process over those 25 plus or 30 years?
It's a learning curve. Anybody who runs a business, but there's no book of how to be a success in a business. It all just comes with experience. I'm very fortunate in two ways in an outlook of life, and I recognise that. It's one that I'm not materialistic. I like, you know, it's nice to have nice things, but I don't really care. I think also coming from very little and have done quite well, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm very fortunate now in the way that I live, but if it all disappeared tomorrow, I also wouldn't mind. But I would be quite happy. So materialistically, it's okay, because then I'm not too concerned about money. I'm not worried about risk. I'm not worried about having a go. I'm not worried about, well, okay, well, let's just do that then. Like I just go, okay, well, let's just do it. I'm not protective over money. I'm protective over people and staff and making sure that we don't risk people's lives or livelihoods. But I don't care too much. I just want things to be right. And so I think that carefree attitude is helpful in terms of moving forward. And also, every mistake that we've made, whether it's business-wise, decision-making, whatever, they're not mistakes, they're learning curves. And that's the way to look at it. You go, okay, well, we learn from that. If you've made that mistake once and then you do it again and again, well, I mean, that just shows you're not learning. You're constantly having to reassess your look at business, try and drive it forward, make decisions. How do we get better? What do we do? And never resting on your laurels. Those are the things. So there's no written route and path to making a business a success. It's down to, I suppose how many times you get back up if you fall over. That's the thing, you know. It's like riding a bike, in it, when you can ride a bike, but you didn't just get on a bike and ride it, did you? You fell off it a few times, and as long as you learn from it, is it the same thing?
And also, in the early days, it wasn't always easy, was it? I mean, in the early days with your wife, when you were living in a room and working 90-hour weeks and all that kind of thing, I mean, there must have been pressure, I would imagine, you know, before you got as established as you are now.
But again, I don't think there's any different to many people who run their own businesses. Everyone else will have very similar stories about the hardships and hard times and things that went wrong, whether it's a 2008 recession or what's going on now and what you have to do to come through the other side. So I look at it and I look at those things and I go, I wouldn't want to do it all again. And I think if somebody pointed out to you at the beginning, this is how difficult things are going to be, I don't think you'd ever do it. But you have to have a go at it. And then once you are all in, nobody else is helping you here. You've either got to do it or give up. And you go, well, I'm not particularly good at giving things up. And actually, that's quite a lie. I'm quite good at giving things up. I'm not particularly good at giving up at life. I quite like the challenge.
I've tasted some of your food. Not only tastes unbelievable, but if you come somewhere like the Hand and Flowers, looks absolutely stunning. What was it like when you got your first Michelin star?
Well, we won the first star within 10 months of opening. I'd held the star for 2 years previously, or two guides previously. So this was a huge surprise, but it was the first star for our business. To get it within 10 months was amazing. You know, it was a small battered old pub that 10 months later, it was a Michelin star pub, and a couple of proud owners and some great people that were working in the kitchen, in the space and front of house. So it was a very, very special moment. It's something that every chef longs for and dreams for. And, you know, when it happens, it's something that is one of those memories moment.
But then you got another one. I mean, were you the first? Are we right in saying you were the first pub in the world to get 2 Michelin stars?
We were, yeah. We were the first pub to win 2 stars, which is amazing. I mean, I know we say it in the world because there's like no other country's really got pubs. So we were the first pub in the UK to win 2 stars, which was, I mean, something we're super proud of. And that's just down to team and reinvestment in people and business. And, you know, you're only as good as the people that you surround yourself with. I mean, I suppose that's one big thing out of business that I have learned is that you can all recognize your strengths and everybody's very good at telling everybody else what they're good at, right? And that's fine. Oh, I'm really good at this. But actually recognize your real strengths. And they're probably not very many. And those are the core things that you concentrate on. But the most important thing is to recognize your weaknesses, recognize the things that you're not very good at, and then surround yourself with the people who are good at those things and delegate and allow people to grow professionally and personally into those positions and take on the roles that you're not good at or don't want to do, you know, because it has to be done with enthusiasm. And I mean, that is one of the big things is I'm so lucky that over those 15 years, we've got many people that work with this for many, many years, people that I've worked with from pre-opening that are still working with us now. So you get to a point where you have to allow people to grow and become part of that business, and they take ownership of their own lives within your company, within your group, and you allow them to be free. And that builds a much stronger foundation for the whole of the business. It's not just built on me. All right, I'm the one that's sat here talking to you. But the reality of it is I wouldn't be able to be sat here talking to you if I was still in that kitchen supposed to be getting the meat and fish ready for lunch, would I? So it's kind of like you need to allow people to grow and develop. And I thoroughly trust that Ricky, who's cooking the meat and fish at the Hand of Flowers today, will be ready for lunch, even though I haven't got to go and see him.
Do you cook at home, Tom, or do you steer well clear of the home kitchen?
I'm not normally home in the evenings, to be fair. I'm normally home a little later. My little man will have tea. And then if I get home, I'm normally home by about 6:37, if that's an evening off. If not, I'm not home till very late. But we try to cook at a weekend. We always try to do something at a weekend cooking this time. This weekend, what did? We did sweet corn pancakes and chicken schnitzels, which was great. Like, you know, you call it a fancy name, but it's like a massive chicken nugget, isn't it? You know, he's quite happy. You know, those sort of things. It's quite good fun cooking. I enjoy cooking at home with my son. I do enjoy being at home, yeah.
How old is he now, Tom? I think he's quite a bit younger than mine, isn't he?
5.
He's 5. Mine's 11 and we have great times in the kitchen. I'm not really a very good cook. In fact, it's something I got better at in lockdown because I was following a chef called John Gregory Smith on Instagram and I used to play him in my kitchen and like follow these simple recipes. But I love cooking with Jack. I think it's a lovely thing to do together and an appreciation of where your food's coming from and putting something together. Looking at you today, you're in your hoodie there. You're looking really fit and well, Chef Kerridge. But tell me about turning 40 and the incredible transformation you went through.
I mean, many people will say they recognise it when they get to 40. It's a point of reflection, isn't it? And you look at, if you're in your 20s and 30s, you don't even think about it. But as you approach it and you get closer, you start to recognise that it is that, I suppose, midpoint of your life. If you live to 80 years old, that's great. You know, it's brilliant. But that means that you're halfway. You've got to kind of go, you reassess what you've achieved, where you've come from, what you've done. So at that point, I mean, I was going through a reassessment thing and I needed to make a change in my life. I had big issues with consumption, mainly alcohol, but that led to bad food choices. So it was a case of, right, I need to make a wholesale lifestyle change. I don't control things very well. And I'm also not very good in balance. There's no such thing as a glass of wine or a beer or, you know, perhaps a biscuit. If you've opened a packet of biscuits, that's it, it's done. Everything is about volume and excess. I was massively out of control. So then I had to go massively out of control the other way. So it was stopping all booze and trying to get to the gym or in the swimming pool and then try and take a complete lifestyle swerve, like a massive U-turn to stop being such a massive idiot.
I hope you don't mind me talking about the weight, because I mean, you've written books about it to try and help other people. I mean, you're 30 stone, weren't you? And you lost about 12, didn't you?
Yeah, that wasn't the point of losing wait. The books became an offshoot of it because that was personal. And actually, you have to become selfish. When you go on a weight loss journey, you have to become so, it is all about you, become self-obsessed. The only way you're ever going to do it is because you become self-obsessed. You don't go to the pub. You don't go to the curry house. You don't go to the whatever. You just become self-obsessive, almost the same as like pro athletes or Olympians become self-obsessed with what they do. You have to have the same thing. You have to have the same focus. Otherwise, you won't stay on it. When we kind of got to a point where I was much happier, people were asking, how did you do it? What was the mindset? What was the... So the point of writing the first book, the Dopamine Diet book, was to make sure that we got to a level and a point where I just thought, if it helps one person, these are the recipes that I were cooking, these are what I did. If it helps one person make that change in their life, then it's worth writing down. And it turned out to be much bigger. I suppose when you find yourself in the public eye and you appear on television and, you know, 1 minute you're like massive and the next minute you're not so big and you're going, okay, people want to know. And then from there, the BBC asked if, you know, we would do a show about weight loss and whatever. And so it kind of all rolled. I didn't see myself as some sort of weight loss guru. I'm not a nutritionist. I'm not a personal trainer. I'm not a dietitian. I'm just like a bloke that lost a load of weight. And this is kind of how I did it. And the one thing that I suppose connected with many people is the fact that although we've got 2 Michelin stars, I'm not the guy in the really pressed chef whites. You know, I'm not the one with a French accent. I'm the one with a West Country accent and wears a T-shirt. So it connects and resonates with people. There's so much more to weight loss than just about nutrition and diet and fitness. And so much of that is the mentality of it and embracing foods that you can eat rather than wearing the ones that you can't. And all of the slight mental tips and tricks. And this is what we try to push onto with the book and particularly the TV shows as well, is actually talking to people, connecting with human beings. Those are the things that make a big, big difference, and getting to grips with understanding it or helping people that need to lose weight understand it. And it's still an issue every single day, because I think I'm probably at that point, like everyone else that's my age, is that balance between eating something rubbish and feeling guilty and going to the gym. You know, that round, but that constant kind of spiral, that hamster wheel that we're all on. So I found myself in that position that I suppose is a bit more normal. Do you know what I mean? It's not extreme one way or extreme the other, but it is most wavy up and down, like most people go through. It's the same thing, but it will never go away.
What I love, though, that you had the word dopamine in the title, because food is there to nourish us, but it's also there to make us feel good. And I think what's lovely about you putting out those recipes, which I know you did sort of afterwards when people were curious about how you manage this, it's lovely that there's recipes out there. We've still got to enjoy our food. I mean, the worst thing about dieting is people being hungry and finding it such a chore, whereas you were choosing stuff, weren't you, that still made you feel good and that you enjoyed, which is brilliant.
Well, that was one thing why a low-carb diet suited me and suits me best, is because you can still eat plenty of it. There's not the hunger thing. Low calorie, I've done that as well. I've done that, put myself through it for a TV show where I lost 2 stone on the telly. And the low calorie thing works for a lot of people, because you can get, it's completely balanced in the way that you have mixed foods, you have carbohydrates, you have sugars, you have whatever. So, but it's just all within a calorific values. The problem with that is that it can leave you hungry if you've had something that is higher in calorific value. If you cut out all carbohydrates, for me, again, it was something that's quite extreme. Cut out everything, right? I'm going to just not do that and go, that's the way I'm going to do this. And it was easier to focus on, but it still meant that you could eat as much protein or plenty of vegetables, you know, kind of like green leafy veg, high in flavor things, that without having to then feel hungry. And that's why it worked for me. But all these diets work. They all work. This is what so many people, and I've never known anything like it in the world of diet club people, that will always, this is the way to lose weight, not that way. This is how to do it. That doesn't matter. It's like, actually, hold on a minute. Chill out, guys. That is the way that worked for you. Everybody is different. We all have different issues and we all have different mentalities and we all have different metabolisms and we all have different. So all of these diets work because people have lost weight on them, right? And they've lost weight on them because they focus, it's the one that's worked for them. They've been able to stay true to it. So all of the diets work. You just really need to do a bit of research and find the right one that suits you, that will allow you to stay on that journey.
And do you feel good, Tom? I mean, do you feel good being lighter and fitter and more energetic?
Yeah, I mean, I go through phases. I went through a period where I was quite lean because I was swimming, and I was swimming every day. So I was kind of like, I'm quite tall. So I'm 6'3". So there was quite a long stretch on my arm. Like I was, I loved the swimming. And then I went through a period of weightlifting and I got really quite big. And then I lost all the weight again. And now I've gone back to the weightlifting. So I've got a target of something that I'm trying to achieve in terms of a weight. And then in my head, I'm going, well, and then I'll go back to swimming. So I'm on this wave. So I'm getting bigger at the minute in terms of, I suppose, muscle build. And then I'll probably, once I've hit the thing that I want to do, then I'll go on swimming and kind of slim down again. I just, to be honest, it's a constant challenge and battle, but it's something that I enjoy questioning and pushing. And, you know, it's way better than sitting on a sofa and not doing it.
So what plans and hopes for this year, for 2021?
To be honest, it's trying to just ensure that we kind of get hospitality back on its feet, our businesses stay secure and strong, and we rebuild that foundation of level of trust and customer expectation whilst trying to keep all of our colleagues in work. And that, you know, that is essentially, you know, and I think that's going to be the challenge for the next 2 or 3 years. There is no profit margins here. There's nothing, you know, there isn't anything. We're not talking about businesses making money at the minute, trying to recuperate the losses of the last year, which have been catastrophic. The amount of loans that many businesses, ours itself included, that we've had to take out just to get to reopen. So we need to operate at some form of profit at some point to be able to pay a loan back to get through to the point to then we're at ground zero again before we can even think of moving forward. So we're years away, and like many hospitality businesses, years and years away of existing in a vibrant and upbeat, bouncy, cash flow rich space. But that doesn't mean to say that that vibrancy and that energy shouldn't be bouncing through restaurants. It just means that behind the scenes, the accountants and the people that deal with the spreadsheets are still pulling their hair out. And that's one of the bits that I hate doing. So that's why I've employed other people to do that. I can do the bouncy fun bit at the front.
Before I let you go, what's your favourite food? When you sit down and relax and you enjoy something delicious, perhaps from one of your menus, what's your favourite?
I mean, to be honest, it's very different. Like if you go into a restaurant, pubs and restaurants, I enjoy real simple food. Like if you go out for something to eat, someone like the Sportsman in Sea Salter is an amazing pub, very simple food, but beautifully cooked, amazingly executed. Spanish tapas restaurants like Sabor, I absolutely love. I think they're great. The simplicity of food like that, I think is fantastic. But if I'm at home, we'll always do curries and spicy food. You know, it's not something that we really enter into the restaurants because I don't understand it enough. It's not a background of cooking that I come from, but I do enjoy having a go at it at home. I do love that vibrance. I love a big bowl of something sloppy and spicy in front of the telly.
I love that about you, a big bowl of something sloppy and spicy. It really has been brilliant chatting to you today. Thanks so much for making time, and I hope I'll meet you in person at some point. I'll have a drive out to the Hand and Flowers. You do a bit of a wicked Scotch egg there, don't you?
It doesn't appear at a Hand and Flowers anymore. We're doing more of a gala pie now, but Scotch eggs definitely appear. They're on the Coach, which is just down the road, and they're at Kerridge's Bar and Grill in the centre of London, and the Bull and Bear up in Manchester. They do make appearances, yeah. So that could count.
Perhaps we can have a Scotch egg together.
Exactly that, yeah.
You've been listening to Chef Tom Kerridge of the Michelin-starred variety. I hope you've enjoyed his stories as much as I have. Join me next week on The Convex Conversation for another great guest. You can download our whole podcast series at convex.podbean.com, so don't forget to subscribe or search for us on Spotify, Apple and Google Podcasts and YouTube, or just ask Alexa. Have a great week. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.